So while we get settled, I will just make that quick announcement. Definitely no class next week. It's Easter Monday. It's spring break for all traditional calendar schools. It's like that. So we had already planned a week off next Monday. So this month we've had 3 classes and 1 snow day. We'll take a week off and then we'll come back April 9th for 2 to 3 more classes, depending on how much progress we make. But right now we're scheduled for 3 classes in April, so keep that in mind. Other than the schedule, I don't have any announcements, but I want to make sure everybody knows that we're taking a week off. All right. Dawn Brown.
Let's start out by reading the 3 principles of the path. Anybody want to tell me where that is? I bet I can find it.
141.
Okay. So this is, just to prepare our minds for this. This is the, 3 principles of the path is like all the teachings that we teach at Kadampa Center can be summarized, you might say, in these 3 principles of the path, distilled into this basic essence. And the 3 principles are renunciation, bodhicitta, which is the topic of our course, and the correct view or emptiness. So some of this is cryptic and you can read it, but we're planting the seeds to have some, if you've never read this before, you don't understand the words, don't be too distraught about that. Just do the best you can and plant the seeds. This is my daughter. Excuse me. Hello. She said, I'm embarrassed. I told her I was teaching a class tonight. She said, dance. Anyway, 3 principles of the prayer. I got it muted now. Maybe I'll make it so that I can't. There's a way to make it so there's no sound that comes. And now I've got that done. Okay. So anyway, we recite these prayers, but kind of let the meaning come in a little bit. And if you don't understand it, just keep a positive mind, and then that aspire to eventually be able to understand the meaning of these words. Okay, I bow down to my perfect gurus, essential meaning of the victorious one's teachings. The path praised by all the holy victors and their children.
The pathway of the fortunate ones desiring liberation. This I shall try to explain
as much as I can. Those who are not attached to the pleasures of circling samsara,
who strive to make
freedom and endowments meaningful, who entrust themselves to the path pleasing the victorious ones, you fortunate ones, listen with a calm mind. Without the complete intention definitely to be free of circling, there is no way to pacify attachments seeking the pleasurable effects of circling. Also by craving for cyclic existence, embodied beings are continuously bound. Therefore, at the very beginning, seek renunciation. Freedom and endowments are difficult to find. Life has no time to spare. By gaining familiarity with this, attraction to the appearances of this life is reversed. Thinking over and over again, their actions and their effects are undeterring
and repeatedly contemplating the miseries of cyclic existence,
attractions to the appearances of future lives is reversed. When by having trained in that way, there is no arising, even for a second, of attraction to the perfections of cyclic existence, and all day and night,
the intention seeking liberation arises,
then the thought of
renunciation has been generated. Even if
renunciation has been developed,
if it is not possessed
by the mind of enlightenment, if it does not become the cause of the perfect bliss of unsurpassed enlightenment, therefore the wise generate the supreme mind of enlightenment. Swept away by the current of the four powerful rivers, tied by the tight bonds of karma so hard to undo, caught in the iron net of self-grasping, completely enveloped by the total darkness of ignorance, endlessly reborn in cyclic existence, ceaselessly tormented by the three poisons,
thinking that all mothers are in such a condition,
generate the supreme mind of enlightenment.
In sword, it's like the mother whose cherished son has fallen into a fan,
and who experiences even 1 second of his suffering as an unbearable eternity.
Your reflection
on the suffering of all mother sentient beings has made it impossible for you to bear their suffering for even 1 second, and the wish seeking enlightenment for their sake arises without effort. Then you have realized the supreme precious mind of enlightenment.
Without the wisdom realizing ultimate reality, even though you have
generated renunciation in the mind of enlightenment, you cannot cut the root cause of suffering. Therefore, attempt a method to realize the dependent arising. One who sees the cause and effect of all phenomena of both cyclic existence and the state beyond sorrow, forever undetraying, and for whom any object trusted in by the grasping mind has completely disappeared, has at that time entered the path pleasing the Buddhas. The appearance of dependent relation, which is undetraying, is accepted separately from emptiness, and as long as they are seen as separate, one has still not realized the Buddha's intent. If these two realizations are happening simultaneously without alternation,
and from merely seeing
dependent relations as completely unbetraying, the ascertainment comes that destroys the way all objects are apprehended as truly existent. At that time, the analysis of the ultimate view is complete. Furthermore, appearance eliminates the extreme of existence, and emptiness eliminates the extreme of non-existence. If you realize how emptiness manifests in the manner of cause and effect, then you are not captivated by wrong notions holding extreme views. In this way, you realize exactly the vital points, the three principal aspects of the path, resort in seeking solitude, to generate the power of effort, and quickly accomplish your final goal, my child. So let's start out with a little bit of meditation. Sit up straight in on your cushion or chair. Start out with a couple of exaggerated deep breaths, and as you exhale, just let go and any tension in your body, anything that might be occupying your mind, just let it go and let your breath settle down.
this time, just follow the inhalation and exhalation, the whole experience of breathing. You don't have to count. Just keep your mind focused on breathing, whether it be the sensation at the tip of your nose, or the rising and falling of your abdomen, or the expansion of your chest, whatever, wherever you notice it most readily. And you want to follow it all the way through the inhalation to the point where the breath turns and becomes an exhalation, and then it turns again, it becomes an inhalation. Don't let your mind stray even for a millisecond from the experience of your breath. The first meditations that we did, and the first one was equanimity, just as a matter of review, way to review that one. We need to develop a stable mind that's not biased, so that we can develop universal love and universal compassion. And it's impossible if we have such rigid labels as friend, enemy, and stranger. You know, then we don't. We want to get in. We feel compassion only for the people we like, and certainly not the people we dislike or the strangers necessarily. So we need to come up with a way of developing equal regard for all beings. I said, the method we used in our meditation was to start out with somebody in front of us that that we feel attachment toward. We can imagine that person and think of why we feel attachment toward them. And maybe they, you know, they fit what we, you know, think of as an attractive person. They say nice things to us and so forth. So, in any case, anything that we are attached to, the very nature of attachment is to project onto that object, that person in this case, qualities way beyond what's there. Not saying that he or she are not attractive or whatever, but we are, or don't have these good qualities that you perceive. But then the nature of attachment is to exaggerate these good things and to underestimate the negative ones. And then we get drawn into kind of a distorted relationship. Always going to be disappointed because we've overestimated the good qualities of the friend or this person that we attach to. That relationship is problematic for a lot of reasons. Number one is it is completely changeable. It doesn't last. There's not a relationship we have right now that will last. I mean, for obvious reasons, we're all going to die, so that we're going to separate from everyone at some point. Either they'll separate from us, they'll die first, or we'll die first. But in any case, none of these relationships will last. But even within this lifetime, there's so many changes. People get married and divorced. Married to their best friend, divorced to their worst enemy. So there's nothing is stable in samsara. This world of uncontrolled causation that we struggle against, trying to perfect it, find the perfect partner, the perfect house, the perfect job, the perfect bank account, the perfect everything. But nothing lasts. Everything changes. So the friend can become a stranger. The friend can become an enemy. And then, excuse me, in past lifetimes, again, if you have to invite those who have issues or just don't have any feeling at all for past lifetimes, you can just go along with the game of past lifetimes. The mind is beginningless. That makes sense. Well, let's put it this way. Time is beginningless, and that makes sense. And in the Buddhist view is that the mind is beginningless. Right? So in every lifetime, we've had, we've been in every possible relationship with every sentient being. That's possible. Plausible. So, we think, we're trying to get a balanced attitude toward the person that we're attached to. So let's focus on some things that didn't go so well in past lifetimes, like when they were my worst enemy, when they harmed me, when they, chopped my body up into little pieces and, fed it, to whatever. The point is to get to a more level-mindedness about this so-called friend of the being that we're attached to. Yes, they have positive qualities, but they also have, there's another side to them as well. So then we do this with each of these different, we try to remember the impermanent nature of each one of these three categories of beings, friends, enemy, and stranger. And we try to remember a little bit about past lifetimes, if you have some, if you're open to that, how they've all been in various relationships with us. So the next, you can go to the stranger, which is the majority of people or living beings. And we remind ourselves that just a few kind words, the person that we currently label stranger, as if they're somehow always and forever will be a stranger, just a few kind words and the label changes. They become friends. Or a few unkind words or careless words, and that person gets labeled enemy. And we believe so strongly in our labels, like somehow that's the truth, knowing full well that the labels can change at any moment. But the way we see reality is not that way. We get stuck in our labeling. And so then, in past lifetimes, this so-called stranger has been like best friend, worst enemy. And you might think, well, why should I, you know, worst enemy? That didn't sound very good. But it's interesting that in the lifetimes where they were kind to me, that's actually, and I was kind to them, but kindness was the feature of that relationship. Kindness is based on respect and cherishing others, which is really based on a realistic view of things. When the delusions pervade the mind, then negativity arises in the mind. So hatred and fear and all the negative mind states that turns somebody into an enemy. So the valid relationship is the positive one, actually. But if we're trying to get a equal regard for all beings, we realize that, yes, they're not just somebody that doesn't really exist for us, but, you know, in past lifetimes, they have been family, and they have been our worst enemy. And even in this lifetime, it's changeable. Could be friend, could become enemy, could stay a stranger. But definitely we're connected to them. Definitely there's a connection. Apathy is not, it doesn't help the mind, and it's not a valid emotion in this respect. And all three categories of beings are like us in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. They're just like us. And then the so-called enemy, when we bring them to mind and allow aversion to arise in the mind, you know, we look and see that label, based on something that they did or said that angered us, that angered me, that made me unhappy. It's interesting that I just read something recently that the Dalai Lama had one of these mind life conferences, and a Western scientist, I think it was a psychologist or whatever, said that the people that had the worst health that were the ones that used I, me, and mine the most. Yeah, this self-centered attitude, you know, that causes so many problems, can affect our health and our happiness. Someone offends me, but they get labeled enemy. Right? However, that relationship could change. It could change at any moment. A few kind words, boom, they become a friend. And in past lifetimes, they've been extremely kind to me. And again, the nature of this negative attachment, which is what aversion is, we see it and we go, gosh, I can't wait to get away from her or him. You know, I'm attached to not liking you, is one way of saying it. And so anybody that we feel aversion toward, anything we feel aversion toward, we've overestimated the negativity of that. So we need to come into a more balanced way of looking at it. We have to focus on the positive qualities of the so-called enemy. So they could become a friend. In past lifetimes, they've been kind to us, like our family. That who teaches us patience? Yeah, the enemy, the person that pushes our buttons, that gives us a hard time. That's the person that teaches us tolerance and patience. And the so-called enemy is the enemy of our worst, is the enemy of our worst enemy. Let me say this right. Yeah, that's right. This person that we dislike points out our flaws. They go right straight for our ego, which is our biggest enemy. They point out our flaws. They point out areas where we need to work on ourselves. If nothing else, just to develop more patience and tolerance. And then, according to the laws of karma, the so-called enemy, it's just the vehicle by which our negative karma comes back. So, we did something in a past lifetime, on our mental continuum, whatever form it was taking. In a merely label way, because, you know, who knows what form we had at that time, but that being that's connected to me in former lifetime created the karma to have future suffering. And so this being that is harming me now is only the fruition of my own past actions. They're not the cause. They look like the cause of the harm, but the real cause of the harm is the self-centered, self-cherishing mind that dwells right in the depth of my heart. That's the demon that we have to conquer. So we want to point out there and say, oh, there's the enemy. But no, that's the real enemy is our selfishness. So again, a more balanced view now. We see the so-called enemy has positive qualities too. It's a label. Could change. It's not inherently existent enemy, inherently existent stranger, inherently existent friend. That will always and forever be that way. Those labels can change. And in past lifetimes, we've had all different kinds of relationships with each of them. And in the most important way, they're just like we are, wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. So trying to develop this level-minded, equal, sort of level-mindedness toward the three kinds of beings, friend, stranger, and enemy. We call it equanimity. So that what follows from the equanimity meditation is some that we did review last week. Was this six cause and effect, the six cause and one effect, or seven cause and effect, sometimes call that. The effect is bodhicitta, and it's the seventh point. But the first six ones that lead up to that are, first of all, seeing all sentient beings as having been our mother in past lifetimes. We choose that relationship, but it could be any close relationship, but that for most people is the most selfless, closest relationship that they'll have. So we, you know, briefly we remember that the mother of this lifetime has been our mom in countless previous lifetimes and will again be our mother in future lifetimes. And so every being, even small insects that are sentient beings, have had that relationship with us, of being like family, like our mother. So we start with our mom of this life and then extrapolate out and think that all living beings, and it's much easier to think of humans potentially being our mother, but then when you get to animals and insects, it gets a little hard. But just, you begin to open your mind up to this possibility that anything with a consciousness had to be reborn, you know, many, many, many countless times and you know, could have had that relationship possible. So we, with familiarity, gaining very, not easy to do, this meditation, but with familiarity with it, then when we see any, you know, living being, whether animal or human, we automatically feel some connection to them. Then we reflect on the kindness of our mother of this life, you know, recollecting, you know, pregnancy and how she took care of us as we grew up, and you know, even if she's alive today, there's a pretty good chance that she would do anything for us, anything. You know, that kind of selfless love that our mom had for us is the kind of love we want to generate for all living beings. So we start out by developing that love for the mom of this life. May you be happy and have the causes of happiness. And then you extrapolate that out to, you know, friends and family, and then strangers, and then maybe including people we dislike, and then, you know, universal living beings. Okay, so now we've gone, all beings have been our mother, and they've been extremely kind to us. So now we see, with the practice, when we see other beings, we immediately feel some kind of connection and warmth toward them without even thinking about it when we've done this practice well. And then the next step is wishing to repay their kindness. And it's like it's not somebody else's job. If somebody's been kind to you and done some sort of kind gesture, it's our responsibility to repay that kindness. And what better way to repay their kindness than to you know, not only help them with their temporal needs of food, clothing, and shelter, and so forth, but also their ultimate needs, their spiritual needs. You know, all the way up from wherever they are in samsaric suffering to guiding them to the path, to the Dharma, and then along, you know, introducing them, and, or even becoming, reliable teacher, and then guiding them all the way to supreme enlightenment. Because they do, we all have that potential, that Buddha potential. So all sentient beings have that potential, and what they want is lasting happiness, not temporary excitement or joy or even, yeah. We all want lasting happiness, and we don't have it. So we must repay their kindness by helping them in not only temporal but ultimate ways. Then we have universal love, which doesn't exclude any living being. It's wishing, you know, all beings, may you have happiness and the causes of happiness. And then we have, you know, universal compassion. May you be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. And again, if we don't have love first, if we don't have that feeling of connection and warmth, then when we see others suffering, there's a danger that we won't feel anything, or we might even feel anger. So we have to work on developing universal love. Then when we see their suffering, which we all experience, I mean, the First Noble Truth talks about all the, we know how existence is problematic. As long as we're out of control, it's problematic. So we wish, may you be free of suffering and its causes. And now, this is actually the preliminary meditations, actually more than the preliminary, leading up to the next type of, next method of developing bodhicitta called exchanging self with others. So we're going to stop. But every time, it's much more powerful to do the meditations on developing bodhicitta if we go through, you know, first of all, at least the first five or so meditations on exchanging self, on the six causes and effect. We do those first. Then we lead into the exchanging self and others. Much more powerful. Okay, just relax your attention. Questions, comments? Yeah.
So exchanging yourself for others, that's a meditation, right?
Yeah, that's what we're getting ready to do.
So do you take on the sufferings of others? And I mean, wouldn't that make you sick?
No. No, you can't do it yet anyway. But it's the attitude that you're trying to develop.
You wouldn't take on their, you know, physical.
No. As I'll tell you, there's somebody asked this question to a Tibetan Lama one time and said, well, if I meditate on taking on the suffering of others, and I get sick, you know. That's not too good for me. And he goes, and he says, basically the question was, what happens if I can take on the suffering of others? He goes, great. Lucky for you that you can take on others.
But because he's suffering. A lama, he could handle it.
No, this wasn't a lama. He said, anybody. If you could practice Tonglin and take on the suffering of others and give them happiness, then that would be fantastic. That's what he said, which, you know, this is, we'll get to it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So this is how I've done this in the past. I think I'll write it on the board. I'm sorry?
Okay.
No, I can do it. I'm going to do this. This is pretty straightforward anyway. So the practice of exchanging self for others and then Tonglin, which is giving and taking, that's called Lojong. Lojong. So it's so we're going to do the first one. The first part of this is to do first step on this is seeing the equality. Of this also, this practice is more profound and more powerful than the six causes and effect. Usually it's thought of that way. However, the six cause and effect, generates usually more emotion, you know, and compassion is an emotion, not just a concept. So that's why combining these two methods is more powerful than just doing this one alone. Equality of self and others. And I'll say a little bit about this. Right now, do we feel like that self and others are equal? You feel equal to other people?
No.
Yeah. No. Who's the center of the universe?
Me.
Everybody raise your hand. We all think we're the most important one, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if somebody offends me, they get labeled enemy. You know, everything is, the referent is I, me, me, me. You know, like I said, not helpful, but it is a fact. Mm-hmm. Now, there is, there's a nominal self and there's a nominal other, right? We usually think of others as singular, don't we? Others, we do. And self is one. But in fact, others are infinite. You know, others all one, you know, we're all equally the same in one. In this meditation, the main thing we want to remember is that we're all equal in wanting what? Happiness, and in wanting to avoid suffering. We all want that the same. And so, I remember, I think it was Geshe Donyo, one Lama that came through here said it's the most powerful way to develop loving kindness is remembering that everybody is just like we are. If you go someplace and you look in the eyes of people and you go, you know, he or she, without saying it out loud, but go, they're just like me. They want to be happy and they want to suffer. But you look, you know, they might be doing all kinds of stuff or being cool or saying clever things or being funny. But that's their driving force behind everything that they do is that they want to be happy and don't want to suffer. And they're just like I am. They're equal. They're not better. They're not worse. We all want the same. So the quality of self and others, this is really important. And again, this meditation particularly, you really have to understand a little bit about emptiness, or at least open to the possibility of emptiness, because there is no inherently existent self or others, although they're nominally different, right? Now, number two,
Well, that goes for animals too,
right? Yeah, well, others are infinite living beings, sentient beings, all sentient beings. Number two is the faults of, self, I'm going to say self-centeredness. That's an easy way to say it, self-centeredness. Or selfishness. Anybody believe that? Anybody want to argue with or debate this point? By the way, when I saw this, I was completely shocked. First time I went, you got to be kidding me. I thought looking after number one was like the only game in town. You know, I thought that, you know, our culture is like the me generation, you know, look after number one, blah, blah, blah. And all of a sudden I'm finding out that I've been doing it all wrong. I'm serious. I was really taken back by this. I thought, my goodness, I'm in trouble now. I was in trouble before, but now I know I'm in trouble. And I mean, I'm being a little bit simplistic here, but, you know, I didn't realize that all of our problems in samsara come from this.
Self-centeredness.
I like centeredness. I know, but you know what? I like centeredness. I think I'm going to leave it like that. Yeah, centeredness is a new word for the, we'll find it next week probably in the dictionary. So this is, anyway, Buddhism would say all the suffering in samsara comes from this mistake. Self-cherishing. First off, we have self-grasping, where we grasp at a sense of an independent self, and then we cherish that self. We think we're this so important, and it creates all the problems, right? You remember the eight worldly dharmas? We've talked about that. The things that you think are delicious, and the things that you think are not so delicious. Everything that's delicious, self-centeredness wants that, doesn't it? And everything that's not, that we label, bad and wrong, we don't want that. We feel aversion toward it. So we're attracted to, you know, pleasure, gain, fame, and praise, and everything else that's delicious. It's all based on me, me, I, and we feel aversion toward loss, disgrace, blame, and pain. Things, all the stuff that's death, sickness, old age, and death. Anything that's that we consider to be negative, we feel aversion toward. We don't want it, and it's all based on this self-centered attitude of what's going to make me happy. And so we say all the negative karma from the beginning of beginningless time until now, all the suffering of the individual, of nations, you name it, every bit of suffering throughout the universe up until the present moment is because of this attitude. And I would invite you to take a look at your life and see if this is true. If this is true, then we have to have some kind of contract with ourselves to figure out a way to undermine it, because it's destroying our, it'll destroy us right up to our last breath. It will rob us of our potential for joy and happiness. So we have to figure out a way to deal with this. And then number three is the great, the value. I don't know how to say it any other way. You could just say value. Of cherishing others. So long as Opa has a bumper sticker that says, for happiness, cherish others. Pretty simple. For happiness, cherish others. This attitude is cherishing others. I think this is true. This attitude is more like going out, isn't it? Cherishing others. May you have happiness and have the causes of happiness. You know? May you be free of suffering and the cause of, but I'm focused out. This attitude is totally, you know, it's totally sucky. It's focused in. It's going in the opposite direction. So this attitude is the antidote to this attitude. So we could say, you know, when we look at at least the non-virtues of body and speech, it's easy to see how if we cherished others, you know, when we talk about the 10 non-virtuous actions, we say the three of body are killing and stealing and adultery, and the four of speech are lying, slander, harsh, and frivolous talk. Well, we can see if we cherished others, we wouldn't kill them, we wouldn't steal from them, we wouldn't cheat on them, we wouldn't lie, we wouldn't badmouth them, you know, we wouldn't speak harshly to them, we wouldn't waste their time with idle gossip. We can see cherishing others is the cause of all happiness. And so we need to learn how to familiarize ourselves with this attitude and begin to purify. We need to begin to let go of this instinctive mistaken attitude, this based on a wrong concept of how we exist. We don't exist that way. We don't exist as a concrete self that we would necessarily cling to, but we do. All right, then the fourth step is, I'm going to put down exchanging. Anybody? Wait a minute. This is how I like to write change. Exchanging self with others. Exchanging self with others. Does that mean you're becoming somebody else? Like I become you, you become me? Is that what that is? Anybody read about this? Anybody want to take a shot at it? What does it mean? Actually, what it means is real simple. What we want to do is our habit now is self-centeredness. And the habit we want to develop is cherishing others. So what we want to do is exchange our self-centered attitude for one that cherishes others. So now, you know, and you have to do this. I mean, this is a conscious thing that you do in meditation where you say, okay, I've spent my entire life up until now cherishing myself, self-centeredness, self-cherishing selfishness. All right, I'm going to exchange that mind for the mind that cherishes others. You know, so again, for happiness, cherish others. So what is that going to look like? We get up in the morning, and from the very beginning in the morning, we set our motivation to work for the happiness of others. You know, by the, there's a little saying that Lama Zopa has, and we did it at the retreat, but it's sort of, the basic bottom line is, you wake up in the morning and you set your motivation to do as much as you can for the benefit of others. Lama Yeshe used to say, "Is you know," and he was a great teacher and yogi, and I mean he was the one that's really responsible for Kadampa Center. And he said, he was very humble too. He says, "As much as I can, I dedicate my life to others." So, you know, this is what this is. We're letting as much as you can. Let go of the self-centered attitude and start focusing on others. Now, at this point, some people go, well, I give you know, particularly that there are other people do this too, but particularly you see mothers, women, but sometimes men too, that have, you know, they've completely given over, you know, lost themselves in parenting, you might say, and have, you know, dedicated their lives to their kids to the point that they feel totally depleted. Now, what happened? Is that a contradiction to what I'm saying? Anybody experience that here in the room?
Can you repeat that?
Yeah, I'm saying that sometimes if you cherish others, let's say your children, you have children, you take care of them, and you put all your energy into taking care of them, and the next thing you know, you're emotionally and physically exhausted and depleted, you know, and you think, well, I've given my whole life to these kids, and for whatever reason, you know, and it hasn't made me happy, basically. I'm just burned out. What happened?
You're expecting something from it.
Pardon?
Like you said, I guess joyful effort. But
that you're expecting something from that. That if you just that joyful effort came to mind. That if you put out there, and I can see that with parenting, and you put so much into your children, but to not necessarily expect something back right away, or you do good and put good out there and not expect something.
Yeah. I would agree with that. Anybody else have a thought about it?
I had this discussion before. I think when you miss self-care, self-compassion through the process, then at the end you will be burnt out. So if you take care of yourself equally while you're giving to others,
right,
then I think you have a plus.
Very good. I like that too. That makes perfect sense. You know, we have to bring wisdom to this process, don't we? If you just go out and, you know, just burn yourself out, burn up literally, trying to help others and not taking care of yourself, not eating and sleeping and doing the things that you need to do, you can't finish what you do. So one statement, I've never seen this in a Buddhist text, but I do think it's true. The best way to take care of yourself is to take care of others. So that's kind of what we're saying. The best way to take care of others is to take care of yourself. Sounds like a contradiction, but it's not. It's like a koan. Yeah.
I'll try to balance the concept, though, of if you truly were there to help others, that's the old cliche, like in a sporting event, you left nothing on the field.
Right.
You put it all out there.
Right.
I don't see that as a bad thing. Would threw it in this when you said you did that and you're not happy.
Yeah.
That's the part that's the kicker, I guess. I can see where it could be good where you have nothing left.
Mm-hmm.
Because what do you want to have left if what you wanted to do
right.
was to truly be there
right.
for others?
Right.
What are you holding on to?
Yeah.
I can see that. But I can also have seen cases where people really gave and gave and gave and really weren't very contented at the end of it.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to, I mean, you made me think, were they expecting something? I wasn't really there to give, I was there to trade.
Yeah. That's a good point. Well, you know, until we get enlightened, we're going to have everything we do is going to be driven by, at some level, egocentricity. Even when we do nice things for people, we're thinking, I'm going to take care of my kids and take them on a nice vacation so they can be happy. so I can be happy.
That's what I'm talking about. I'm going to Disney World so I can be happy. Without
you read my mind.
I have found by personal experience that and this not only applies to parenting, it's for everything else, work, you know, right. Wherever you, whatever your endeavor is, that when you use your children or parenting for justifying your sense of self, like the self-cherishing,
right.
That then that's when you get burnout. That's when I get burnout. When I use it to justify, you know, depending on what your idea is of good parent, you know, they should go to this school, they should dress like this, they should sleep like this, or eat like this, or behave like this, then that means I am a good parent, so on and so forth. So if, you know, whenever I use something outside to justify my ego or whatever idea it is I have about that, then that's when I burn myself. But if it comes from a particularly foreign dharma, very useful in parenting because cherishing others genuinely, wanting my kids to be free from suffering, then I parent joyfully. You know, like, I have more energy than ever before, you know, like 10 years ago when I first started, you know. So, and over there I was like, yes, I'm going to do this, and woohoo, and I was completely exhausted, and now, you know, I don't sleep 8 hours, 6, 5, 4, who knows, and I'm still happy. I'm not grouchy or angry. I'm joyful, you know, oh, yeah. So I think that the self-cherishing attitude towards parenting is what, you know, burns me, at least.
Yeah.
I don't know if that happens with others, but for me, that I found that very enlightening when I found that, these teachings. And
anybody else? Okay. So this is juicy enough right here. The next step is the two ways, you know, two other meditations that we do, and where we can combine the two. But one of them is giving, giving love, and the other is similar to the other meditations. But I like Tonglen now. So this is where we would do Tonglen practice, which is taking and which is it, anyway. Tonglen means giving and taking, and if you read the different texts, sometimes they say, "Well, really, you should take the suffering of others first before you give them happiness, because they can't be happy if you haven't taken their suffering away." Well, on the other, you know, that might be true, but if there's somebody you dislike, then you have to develop loving kindness for them first, so you give them happiness. And you know, we're just doing away a method of developing compassion and loving kindness. So we're going to focus on Tonglen next week, or the next time we meet in a couple of weeks. We're going to do the whole class on that subject. I think Tonglen and I like the 13 meditations, the 11 steps in developing bodhicitta. I really like those. And I think if you did that every day, you would, you know, you would be a happier person for doing it. By the way, I remember so many times when I had more time to meditate than I do these days with kids. But anyway, I used to do that meditation every day, and I'd get up and do it. Then I'd go to work, or I'd do something really bad. And I'd go, darn, that meditation's not working yet. But you know, that's just what you do as a Dharma practitioner. You make mistakes.
So now you do really bad things without having meditation.
Now I try to clean up my messes as I go, because I have a lot of faith in karma, and I do believe that as soon as I make a mistake, the quicker I clean it up, the better chance I have of not getting stung by the boomerang of karma, you know, getting my neck rung off. So anyway.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
The value of cherishing others, right? So is this a general kind of thing? I mean, you know, you look at someone like Hitler and you say, well, how in the world can I cherish him? I mean, or a serial killer, Ted Bundy or something. Is that like a general...
It's everybody. Because you got to remember, before this, we've already done meditations on equanimity. This is a foundation where we've, as much as we can, we've let go of aversion for the enemy, Hitler. Saddam Hussein, you fill in the blank. Anybody you don't like.
So just don't think of them. Or,
well, you're trying to see him. He's trying to start this whole process out with this level-mindedness of equanimity. Then you can do this. You can't do it if you haven't done the meditations preceding. This doesn't quite fit, does it? But as one of my teachers said, and Lama Zopa emphasizes this every time he comes here, he says, cherishing others is so important. It's so important because it's definitely, and another teacher said, others are swimming in good qualities. People that we dislike are swimming in good qualities, and we don't see it because our negative mind sees what it wants to see. It picks out the faults, the flaws in things, and then embellishes them and focuses on them and reifies them and defines that person by whatever we see as negative. But they have a lot of good qualities. Otherwise, nobody would like them. And they do. I mean, even the baddest of the bad people have friends, or at least people that they're connected to. Probably.
People are complex.
Yeah. It's tricky. So, you know, people are swimming in good qualities. So we need to focus on these good qualities in cherishing others, don't we? You want to focus, you can't cherish others and think that they're a jerk. Again, you have to have done some work ahead of time. You know? Equanimity, you know. Seeing everybody as mother, remembering their kindness, wishing to repay their kindness, the equality of self and others. Everybody wants to be happy. Nobody wants to suffer. The faults of self-cherishing, the great value of cherishing others, and exchanging. Anyway, you got to. All of that leads up to this point. Yeah.
Maybe Aaron remembers it. It's been a while. It might have been in one of these classes or something, but like she was saying, someone that, you know, society views as heinous, like Hitler or a serial killer or something, and it helps me to do this, it's to say, you know, get rid of your ideas and your ego. It's to say, if I was in their position, raised in their environment, under that same situation, how can I say I wouldn't have done the same exact thing?
Yeah. Well, I tell you, George Dreyfus, who was he was the first Westerner to get a Geshe's degree, actually a Larumpa Geshe degree, and George was from Switzerland, the French speaking part of Switzerland. He's Jewish, and he came to Chapel Hill many, you know, 25, 30, you know, long time ago anyway, when we had a little Dharma group over there, he visited. He came down. He was a professor. At the time, he was at UVA, but he subsequently became a professor at Williams College in Western Massachusetts, which is a really good school, I've been told. But anyway, he is smart. He was really smart. He says, I can see that in my own mind, that I have the potential to be a Hitler. Or, you know, we all have that potential to do something really heinous. Heinous? Whatever. We all have that potential, given putting in the situation. I mean, these people that turned on the gas. I mean, Hitler didn't run around all the gas chambers and places like that where Jews were killed during the Second World War and turn on the gas chambers. He had people that did his dirty work for him. But there was a lot of, I mean, I've heard stories that, you know, if you don't do this, your family will be killed. You'll be killed. You know, there was a lot of pressure, so they did what they had to do to survive in that moment. Yeah. But getting back to this, go ahead.
Well, I almost think if it's not that I don't have the potential to be able to do something like that, somewhere in this karmic river, I'm pulling behind me. I done did the doctor.
Yeah.
At some point.
We were the baddest of the bad.
I'm dragging something back there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All right, so let's do a little meditation to finish off this evening on the these points, and then we'll be all primed to do Tonglen next time.
What is this called?
Lojo?
Pardon? Is it Lojo?
Well, this is part of exchanging self for others. We haven't finished it yet. Now, the last two parts, again, this sort of universal sense of universal responsibility, so-called supreme wish, where we take personal responsibility to free all beings from suffering. You know, it's my job to free all beings. Can't leave it up to anybody else. I'm gonna, you know, that bodhisattva attitude. That's the next step after Tonglen. And then after that is generating bodhicitta, where we realize that to do what we want to do, we have to eliminate our faults, develop all of our qualities, and become a Buddha. That's the method to help others, which is what we want to do. The method to help others is to become an enlightened being, which simply means eliminating our faults and developing our good qualities to the nth degree. That's how we can really help others. Otherwise, if we're a disaster, we can't even help ourselves, much less others. So let's do this meditation. So start out by settling your mind down, and let's think something good, as Geshe Gelug says. Just focus on the breath and think something neutral for right now. So the first step, we've already done the other steps, right? We're at that point where we started out with equanimity, and then we developed that level-mindedness, equal regard for the three categories of beings, and then we, you know, seeing everybody as mother and remembering their kindness and wishing to repay their kindness. It gets us up to this point where we see the equality of self and others. We want to we want to see how we're more alike than we are different. And the key sort of mantra in this is that everybody wants to be happy and nobody wants to suffer. And we all equally want happiness and equally do not want to suffer. And in this very fundamental way, we are exactly the same. We all want happiness and don't want to suffer equally. Think about the people in your life. And you know, the people that you know, you consider strangers walking down the street in the bus, in the elevator, in the restaurant. Everybody wants the same. And Jeffrey Hopkins says this is the Dalai Lama's favorite meditation. I'm not sure if that's true, but it's like he imagines this imaginary line, and on one side of it is Dalai Lama, and on the other side is universal others, you know, others, which is universal living beings, everybody but him, okay? And he looks at, he thinks, okay, I want to be happy, and I don't want to suffer. And then over on the other side are these infinite beings, you know, countless living beings who want exactly the same thing. So whose happiness is more important? The happiness of one or the happiness of infinite others? Now some teachers would say the happiness of others is more important than the happiness of one person or one being. But it's good for us to just start out and see that just as I want happiness and don't want to suffer, everyone else is exactly the same as I am. And they have the right, just as I do, to have happiness. It's an instinct. There's nothing wrong with wanting to be happy and wanting to avoid suffering. When it becomes an addiction, that's when it causes the suffering, causes the misery. But that's a valid way to think. And so as far as comes to this conclusion that at least, you know, we're equal. We equally want happiness, and that mine is not more important than infinite others. We're all equal. So it's something to think about. And then we think about the faults of self-cherishing selfishness. And just look at the messes that you've had in your life, places where things have not gone well. And maybe in some situations you can't understand, you can't explain it, because it's not really explicable. And you can't remember. And it could have been something that you did in a past lifetime, but many times we can see how selfishness has caused so much suffering in our lives. You know, so in the name of self-cherishing, you know, we've killed, we've stolen, We've committed adultery. We've lied and slandered, spoke harshly and frivolously. And then the three of mine, greed, hatred, and ignorance, are also a function of this mistaken attitude of self-cherishing selfishness. Self-centeredness. And so we have to know, how does it feel? You know, I think this is a good way to identify. And, you know, if we can tune in, like, to the sensations in our body, when the mind is pervaded by that self-centered attitude, it feels constricted, it feels dark. I mean, just, I'm suggesting that you notice this. It may not be that way for you. But generally, you know, people describe it that way. And that's the attitude and that feeling of tightness and constriction and closing down, you might say. That's like our worst enemy. You know, when we're consumed by anger and fear, how constricted that feels. And in the attitude of cherishing others, how spacious that feels, how free that feels, how good it feels. It actually feels good to cherish others because we're focusing on their positive qualities. And they're swimming. They are swimming in positive qualities. And we're choosing to focus on those. Not like we don't see that they're problems, but we're not using that as the focus, because what we want to develop is this attitude of loving others and cherishing them. It's good for our mind, it's good for our health to cherish others. For happiness, cherish others. Simple. Love says, for happiness, cherish others. And then the last step is to exchange self-cherishing, the self-cherishing attitude, which we're very familiar with that. We're gonna let it go. We're not giving it to anybody. We're just letting it go. We're exchanging that for the attitude of cherishing others. So exchanging self for others is letting go of the self-cherishing attitude and adopting the attitude of cherishing others. So that from the moment we wake up in the morning, we make a determination to cherish and serve others as much as I can. I dedicate my life to others like that. And then that pervades our mind all day long, just like the oxygen that we breathe. You know, we get dressed for others. We drink our coffee for others. We try to do our best at our job for others. You know, we respect others. We behave toward them as if they're cherished beings, because that's how we're seeing them now, as cherished beings. We don't do stuff that hurts them. And if we do, we clean it up. You know, we know we're not perfect, but we do our best to avoid harming and as much as we can helping others. And we go through the day with the attitude of cherishing others. And then the last, you know, the Tonglen, where we practice taking on their suffering and giving them happiness. We'll do that next week. That's the meditation that cures leprosy. They call it the leper's meditation in Tibet back in the day because it's so powerful. And then the supreme wish that, you know, I take personal responsibility for the happiness of all beings. And of course, we realize we might have that attitude, but we're not able to do it. So then bodhicitta is we determine to become enlightened in order to help others. So we set as our this really big goal called supreme enlightenment so we can help others. And interestingly, by focusing our energy on helping others, our happiness happens like as a byproduct. We don't have to go out looking for it. It comes along just by the way. Okay, so let's relax our concentration and do our dedication prayers on page 246. I should remember that, 246. All right, so what does dedication mean? It means that, you know, we're dedicating it in a sense that we collectively and individually develop some positive potential. You know, seeds have been planted on the mind stream tonight. And, you know, there's two teachings going on always, is whatever is being said from this position, and then you're hearing it and you're processing it and teaching yourself through your own experiences. So something, you know, hopefully a lot of good has come from both of these teachings, and then we want to give that energy, we want to dedicate it or send it in the direction of supreme enlightenment for the sake of others. We don't want it just to ripen in like a nice lifetime the next time around, or in this life maybe a Lexus or something, although it wouldn't be bad, but we want to do better than that. We want to dedicate it to something bigger, supreme enlightenment. Okay, may all beings everywhere, plagued by suffering of body and mind, attain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with the mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water, delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be free from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Okay, thank you. So there's a homework handout, and Aaron has something to say.
Yeah, I was just going to say the homework's in the back as we walk out. And if you are streaming, it is also posted online. At the end of class, we'll straighten up the chairs a little bit. The water bowls on the left are taken down the normal way, and the water bowls, or the offerings in the middle, are going to be taken down in the opposite direction, and I can help with taking those down. They're from the Guru Puja, so they're a little different. That's it. See you guys in 2 weeks.